Hello, Happy New Year. Last Orders is back. We've got a great episode with Tamandra Harkness, which will start in just one moment. But first, I wanted to answer a question which I know is on all of your minds. What, Tom, is the best way to support this podcast? Well, the answer is giving Spiked a regular donation. Last Orders, like all of Spiked's content, is free. So without our generous listeners and readers, we wouldn't be able to make it and produce it each month. One-off donations are greatly appreciated, but monthly donations are even better as they allow us to plan for the future and for bigger and better things. So if you like what we do and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider signing up. Just £5 each month is a huge help. To do so, just go to spiked-online.com and click the big red donate button in the top right corner. That's spiked-online.com and the big red button. Thanks for all your support, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. This is the show all about freedom, the nanny state, and censorship, though these days there's also a lot about COVID. In this episode, we discuss big tech censorship, Britain's vaccine rollouts, and why sin taxes punish the poor. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. My name's Tom Slater and I'm joined today, as I am every month, with Chris Snowden, Director of Lifestyle Economics at the Institute for Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Thanks, Tom. How are you?
I'm very well, considering the circumstances. It's very bleak winter lockdown. And we're delighted to be joined again on the podcast for a second time by Tamandra Harkness, who's a writer, broadcaster and author of Big Data, Does Size Matter? Tamandra, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
It's a pleasure.
So we're going to talk about a bunch of things today. Big tech censorship, vaccines and the path out of lockdown and how long that might take. Sin taxes as well. Bit of a blast from the past for this podcast, given we talk about COVID so much these days. But let's start with big tech censorship. This has been an issue which is building up for a very long time, particularly in recent years, moves to clamp down on hate speech, misinformation, a lot of things around the COVID crisis as well. But it felt like a line was definitely crossed now about 2 weeks ago when Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, practically every other big social media network kicked then President Donald Trump off of their platforms, as well as a kind of broader purge of a lot of kind of conspiratorial pro-Trump accounts. This all coming after the storming of the Capitol. But even though, as I say, big tech censorship has been an issue for a while, this seemed to shock a lot of people. You had German Chancellor Angela Merkel voicing her concerns, Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, as well as a lot of people who have been concerned about the creep of censorship on these platforms for some time. It even seemed to shock some of these platforms themselves. Jack Dorsey and a few others have come out almost expressing a bit of regret for the fact they had to get this far. But nevertheless, we do have these very big companies wielding a huge amount of power over public discourse. And I guess the question is, how big of a problem is this? And how would we potentially even challenging it, given the power that these companies have? So, Tamandra, just to kick us off, what was your take on the Trump ban in particular? What do you think it represents?
I thought it was pretty dodgy. I do think that there is a line that's long existed, which is that inciting violence or direct threats are not considered to be part of free speech in general, which I think is fair enough. But if you look at the tweets that he was actually banned for, they really weren't doing that at all. They got him on what they call glorifying violence, which is in itself quite a tricky category, because you know, there's all sorts of things that you might say either rhetorically or as a joke or even talking about historical events that you might see as glorifying violence. I mean, you might say, well, I think the Gulf War was good because Saddam was evil and we got rid of him. Is that glorifying violence? I mean, there was a lot of violence happened in that. So I think it was pretty dodgy. I think it was a dodgy category and the tweets don't really apply. But it kind of revealed what was already true, which is these things which feel like digital public spaces are actually private clubs. And like any private club, if they don't like what you're doing, they can kick you out, which would be okay if it were not for the fact that in practice, it's actually very hard to go away and set up your own private club, which is what you would do in the real physical world if you're a millionaire, obviously. But it's very hard because, as we saw with Parler, a lot of people moved to that off Twitter, and then it got shut down because Amazon, who were hosting its servers, said, we don't want you anymore because we don't like your face, basically. So in practice, it's not that easy to go and start your own club. Also, You know, in fact, de facto, the big social media sites are the new public space. That is where people go to have public conversations, not just exchange messages with their friends and existing contacts. And interestingly, I read a piece in last week's Spectator about social media, which traced some of the history in America, where, of course, they have a rather different attitude to free speech. It's actually in the Constitution. They regard it as a very fundamental right of citizens and essential to democracy. And they had a trial some time ago about whether social media sites could censor and delete content, whether they could remove it or not, whether they were publishers, in which case they were liable for anything that was on their site, or whether they were just a platform, in which case they weren't. But did that mean that they were like a utility and they weren't allowed to cut anybody off? And the court ruling kind of came down the middle, said, okay, we won't penalize you if somebody does something on your platform. We won't regard you as a publisher, so you're not at fault. But we also won't penalize you if you decide that somebody crosses your line and you kick them off. So basically, it's up to you. You're not a publisher, but you're also not a public utility. And that was their kind of fudge. And over here, we haven't, in the UK, we haven't really come to grips with that. I mean, our laws are, I think, more restrictive of free speech anyway. And we've not really resolved this thing of, well, what is it? Is it a newspaper? Is it a public square where people should be allowed to say anything? What is it exactly? But to come back to the point, is it a problem if Trump is thrown off it? Well, I think it is a problem, because if it is the public square and you're saying to an elected politician, your views are unacceptable here, then you're basically saying to the electorate, you don't have the right to hear from this person who you may or may not want to vote for in the future, or you may or may not want to hold accountable for things they say and do. And I do think that's a problem. And it's kind of weird, because Twitter had ruled earlier that Trump was not allowed to block people because this was a kind of a constitutional exchange and people should be allowed to hold him to account. So if he was going to say things, people had to be able to answer him. So which one is it? You know, is it a constitutional public space, or is it a private club for people who agree with Twitter? So I do think, in a sense, I think it's the coming to the head of a problem that's been coming a long time, where you basically say, this is public space now, but it's owned by a few companies. And if they don't like the cut of your jib, they can shut you up.
Chris, where do you come down on this question? I guess this is the kind of libertarian's great conundrum, which is that I'm in favour of free speech, but also, you know, quite wary of any interference with these companies and their rights to do what they want. How did you react to the Trump ban in particular? And what do you think the broader issue is here? Where do you come down on that question of, is it a public space or a private company?
Well, I was absolutely furious about the Trump ban because, you know, leaving his politics aside, he clearly was by far the funniest president America's ever had. And he was the king of Twitter. He did the best tweets of anyone on Twitter. So, you know, when he lost the election, I thought, well, you know, that's probably taken away quite a bit of banter from the next 4 years. But it's not like he's died. He'll still be around. He'll still be tweeting. So it doesn't matter that much. And for bloody Twitter to delete his account for pretty shaky reasons, as Tamandra says, it's just appalling. As soon as I found out about it, I tried setting up a Parler account because I thought maybe it'd show up on there. And they closed that down as well. So, no, it's disgusting. And you're right, it's a tricky one for free market libertarians. But I think Tamandra's kind of pointed at what the answer is here, which is, no, they shouldn't be held liable for what they say. But the quid pro quo for that kind of immunity, if you like, should be that they can't kick anybody off. I think that ultimately has to be the answer. Whether that's a free market libertarian answer or not, I don't know. But it doesn't seem to me to be obviously in conflict with free market principles. And I think that is the best, maybe not perfect, but I think that's the best solution to it.
And Tamandra, do you see that as a likely prospect? I mean, one thing that a lot of people talk about, and I know you know a lot about big tech firms, is how difficult it has been to try and, you know, regulate them, or even the kind of reticence on behalf of a lot of governments and politicians to really go down that road. There's a lot of saber rattling often, but not a lot gets done. Do you think there's a genuine prospect of big tech either reforming itself or being reformed in the way that Chris has described there?
I mean, the irony is that, as in so many situations at the moment, what you have is a kind of vast passing the buck, or maybe chucking the hot potato to and fro, because governments are talking a lot about regulation, and I think they will move to regulate. I mean, certainly in, I think, Europe and the UK, but maybe in America as well, given the political trends there. But really, governments don't want to have responsibility for saying what you may or may not say in public. They don't want to be the ones to have to draw the line and get people into court and say that tweet was not permitted. I mean, that has already been happening in the UK, and it's an absolute mess and an embarrassment for all concerned. And quite often, you know, the police will kind of go mob hand to somebody's house and say you tweeted something, and then the courts will just shake their heads and throw it out and say this is absolutely ridiculous. This is not at all what this law was intended for. So the ideal thing for governments really is what they're trying to do is to say, oh, the burden of preventing harm is with you, the company, but you're providing the platform. So you have to prevent harms. And harm is such a big loose category. We're not talking about somebody used your platform to give away a person's private address and say, go kill them, and somebody went to kill them. You know, we're talking about people's feelings being hurt, essentially. People's ideas being contradicted in unacceptable language, depending on who you are. And so I think the government kind of wants to outsource that responsibility. The government doesn't want to be the one censoring people's free speech, but they do want it censored. So it's much easier for them if somebody else can be made to go, well, this is borderline, but if we let it happen and somebody decides it's harm, then we're liable. So we're just going to play it safe because we can, because it's our platform. But on the other hand, I think the big companies, especially the big ones, but all the tech companies, they want regulation because on the one hand, it takes the burden off them. So they don't have to be the ones in the middle going, yeah, well, we allowed all the people to stay on Twitter with pictures of baseball bats and slogans saying kill all TERFs, but we did not allow this woman to say sex is real and exists because that was harmful. And we didn't allow Trump to stay on, even though these things he said was quite vague, but we did allow this other person to come on and say something about killing policemen. They would much rather, I think, have very clear regulations so they can really clearly say, the law says we're not allowed to do this, and the law says you're not allowed to do this, so we're going to stop you. Also, for the big businesses, obviously, regulation is a burden that's much harder for small businesses than for large ones, because Google and Twitter and the like can have, well, they already do have a massive legal department, which can sit there and go through the laws and even ring up the lawmakers and say, what are we talking here? Are we talking this or that? Whereas if you are a little startup, you know, if you're three people in a shed trying to set up an alternative platform based on free speech, then the regulations are going to be a real problem for you because you're going to spend a lot of time going through saying, is this allowed? Is that allowed? If we get this wrong, we'll be taken to court and that will put us out of business. Mm. So I think, ironically, the people pushing for regulation are the companies just as much as politicians.
Chris, finally, before we move on to our next section, I mean, what do you think the prospects are for free speech online? It feels like things are only getting worse. You know, the kind of broader culture around censorship, which kind of informs a lot of this discussion, I guess, seems to be leaning towards the idea that you do have to shut down certain speech, certainly amongst the cultural set and politicians. You've now got a new democratic government. A lot of the decisions big tech companies make will rely on what happens in the US political sphere. And they've been putting constant pressure on these companies who they're very close with and actually do a lot of work with. There's a bit of a revolving door between Democratic Party and big tech. They've just been pushing big tech in one direction, which is to clamp down on misinformation, hate speech, etc. So are things only really going to get worse before they get better, if they get better at all? I mean, what direction do you think we're travelling in at this point?
Well, worse. I mean, you could ask me that about almost any issue and I'll tell you it's getting worse and it's not going to get better. You know me, ray of sunshine. It's all, and you know, in years to come, kids yet born will never believe the freedom we had on the internet, which everybody took completely for
granted.
It's
all right, Chris. They won't be allowed to know about it. It will have been erased from the history books.
Down the memory hole. I mean, there was just a glorious few years, wasn't there, when you could just do anything on the internet and it's just slowly been squeezed. Even these bloody, this GDPR stuff, you know, we're out of the EU now and yet every website you go to, you have to click to accept cookies. Has anybody ever not accepted cookies? What happens if you don't accept cookies? Maybe I should try one time. Does it mean you can't see the website? What's it matter? And it's this endless kind of nonsense you've got to go through. And they'll probably kick us all off Twitter eventually. Maybe something will spring up, to be fair, to replace Twitter. It's certainly not inconceivable. There are massive network effects, obviously, with the likes of Facebook and Twitter. But once the good people have gone, once you get rid of your best tweeters like Trump, if Trump springs up anywhere on any rival to Twitter, I'll be straight on there and a lot of people will follow. And then it just starts to build up again. So these guys are not completely invincible. But yeah, of course things are going to get worse. That's a given.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. Let's talk about one thing in which things seem to be getting better, which is the vaccine. So after making what I think by anyone's estimation has been a terrible go of fighting this pandemic so far, the British government does seem to have one thing to cheer about, which is the rollout of the vaccines. As the time of recording, we've vaccinated about 5 million people. We're already over, as of today, the 2 million a week target, or at least vaccinating at that rate. We're ahead of any other large economy. We're lagging behind Israel, UAE, Bahrain, but far ahead of the EU and various other countries. And I guess what I want to talk about is it going fast enough? Is there anything that we can do to really push this even further to get us out of lockdown as soon as possible? And also, when should we, and when do we think the government is actually going to start listing these restrictions? Because we've been hearing a lot of mixed messages on that front recently. So Chris, first of all, just on the vaccine rollout question specifically, what do you make of it so far? And also, I know you've written about ways in which this could actually be sped up and even more ambitious at this point. So what do you think of where we are at the moment? But also, what do you think could be done to make this even more of a success?
Going pretty well, you've got to say, you know, hats off. It was a bit of a slow start, but they've got up to over 2 million a week, which is the target. It looks like they'll probably, touch wood, reach the 14 million mark by mid-February, which is the overarching target. But yeah, it could be sped up. I mean, I think we did 30 million flu jabs last year. We normally did 15 million and we did 30 million. Certainly that was a target. I don't know if it was quite reached or not, but it kind of shows the capacity here. This is not the Manhattan Project. This is something that the NHS does all the time, actually, without anybody even batting an eyelid. So I don't see why we couldn't get it up to 4 or 5 million jabs a week. We do need to do the second shot, it seems. So, you know, as good as it's looking at the moment, you know, there's a long, long way to go. Way I've suggested making more use of the army, for example, bribing doctors more, just spending everything you can. I mean, there's almost no way in which you could spend money on this and it would be a false economy. You know, the crazy amounts of money that we're already printing and borrowing, it's a drop in the ocean. What we need to do, just throw money at this from every conceivable angle. There are millions of people on furlough. Pay them to do something. They don't necessarily need to be putting needles in people's arms, but they could be going out, you know, driving people to the test center, whatever, you know, I don't know. But just use every possible resource because it will save us so much money because we'll get out of lockdown sooner. And it brings me to the other question, when are we going to get out of lockdown? Obviously, it depends a lot on the vaccines and it depends on the response to the vaccines. You know, I don't want to come across even slightly anti-vaxxer here, so I'll be careful what I say. But this Oxford vaccine, you know, it's always looked a little bit, the evidence looks a little bit shaky for it. You know, all this stuff about 1.5 doses works better than 2 doses. And we know this because we basically made a cock up. And it's a weird thing to happen if it's true. Do you know what I mean? And it's like 62% effective source of in one group. But there were some academics, I think they were probably from Imperial. It was modeling, so it probably was bloody Imperial last week, saying that even if you vaccinate the entire world with the Oxford vaccine, every man, woman, and child, you still wouldn't get to herd immunity. And so obviously the same thing applies to Britain. And you need to vaccinate a crazy number of people with the Pfizer one to get to herd immunity. They said 93%, which doesn't make any sense to, you know, admittedly a, you know, armchair epidemiologist like me. But the Pfizer one is 95% effective. So surely something like 70% would do, wouldn't it? And even if it wouldn't do, if people don't want to take a vaccine that almost certainly will stop you getting the virus, then that is your lookout if you get COVID, as far as I'm concerned. So I don't know. We'll have to see what happens. And we're kind of looking to Israel because they're so far ahead of us. We'll see what happens with the death rate and the case rate in Israel. Obviously, fingers crossed this Oxford vaccine does work. There are other ones on stream and we can get more of the Pfizer one. But, you know, it's a matter of fingers crossed, really, because the evidence on the Oxford one, maybe Tamandra can put me straight on this. Maybe I'm planting unnecessary doubt in people's mind. But it just from their initial press release, it was a bit typical sort of big pharma bullshit. They were kind of putting a bit of a spin on it, which I wasn't too convinced by.
Tamandra, what's your thoughts on the rollout so far?
Well, I mean, I can't add anything to epidemiology. I'm much more relaxed than Chris about the Oxford one. I think they've just tested it on so many people, but it would be nice if the efficacy figures were higher. But the thing in its favour, I think, is that they do have a little evidence that it prevents you passing it on as well, which is clearly a bonus.
What about the homeopathic aspect, where it works better if you take less of it?
Well, one interesting thing about that is they came back later and said, actually, it might not have been the half dose. It might have been that we left the second dose longer because we found out we'd given the wrong dose and went, oh, what should we do? And while they were thinking about it, they left it longer. So they're saying that actually for them, a longer gap might work better. But Pfizer are saying, no, what are you doing? Do what we told you. So who knows? I don't know. I think the whole vaccine story is very, very impressive. I'm getting slightly annoyed with, there's a lot of nature worship going on at the moment. Mainly annoying media types like me who are locked down and working from home and going, oh, no, but it's marvellous because so much more in touch with nature and isn't nature great? And it's put us back in touch with nature. And I'm like, nature's trying to kill you. Nature's trying to kill your family and your friends. You know who's trying to save you here? Big pharma. Academics, the government, you know, all the people we normally hate. Just like, mind your necking. Sorry, it's just my little outburst there. No, I think the vaccine story is incredible. I think to actually get a working vaccine in less than a year is extraordinary.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And, it, you know, it reflects the fact that money and resources and people have been absolutely thrown at it. And, yeah, I broadly agree with Chris that you could not waste money getting people vaccinated quicker because anything that gets us out of lockdown quicker has got to be a good thing, whichever way you look at it. The thing that worries me most is precisely people saying things like, oh, well, we can't release until we have herd immunity, because that would take months and months and months, even if most people say yes to vaccines and you get it in people's arms. Yeah, it's going to take till autumn at best to vaccinate everyone over 18 in the UK. Are we going to stay locked down till autumn? I mean, that's absolute madness. Vaccinate the high-risk groups and you eliminate 95% of the deaths. And that's what we're talking about here, really, is if we can eliminate most of the deaths and most of the serious illnesses, the people who are in hospital for a long time and suffer long-term damage, as you know, a lot of people do, then we are really talking about something that is like the flu. You know, and I've been saying from the start of this, it's not just the flu. It was clear from the start that for certain groups, it was very, very dangerous. And it is very, very dangerous. And, you know, it is killing. It's killed 2 million worldwide. And that's not going to be the end of it. But if we can vaccinate the people at highest risk, then it does become like the flu, which is a disease that's a problem and not nice and you don't want to get it, but we can live with it. We can keep society moving and running while we keep that as a side battle rather than trying to close down the whole of society and stop normal human interaction because that's the only tool that we seem to have in the toolbox.
Does it get the R below one, though? That's a question I can't quite answer. If we do that, we just vaccinate the high-risk groups. Is that enough to get R below one?
Well, not necessarily in the rest of the population.
Because you haven't got herd immunity.
I mean, the thing is, if you've been vaccinated, or it's increasingly, if you have already had it, then it's not a guarantee you won't get it, but you're very unlikely to get it. So then you go, okay, well, you have 10 people in a room, and if each of them has only a 20% chance of catching it now or less, then you know, even if you expose them to somebody very infectious all day, then only one or two of them are going to get it. And that's a big difference from saying all 10 of them might get it and then go and spread it to 100 people and so on and so on and so forth.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So, you know, it would have an impact immediately. But I think my point is that at some point we're going to have to say, actually, this is endemic in the population. And although let's not stop vaccinating. I mean, yeah, God, you know, I've got my arm ready to go, even though I've already had COVID. So let's vaccinate everybody, but I don't think we can wait for herd immunity before we start to get society moving again, because it's
too right.
Lockdown is catastrophic in all sorts of ways, not just economic. I mean, I think for human society, human interaction, human sanity, and I mean that in the broad sense, not the mental health sense. I mean, I would say if you look at some of the wilder conspiracy theories, I go, yeah, that's what happens when you impose a draconian and sometimes arbitrary rule on people and you make them stay home and you stop them having normal conversations with people they'd normally meet who go, microchip in your arm, have a listen to and they spend all their time on the internet finding people who've got an even wilder conspiracy theory. I mean, it's like, it's one of the most predictable outcomes of lockdown policy that you could possibly have thought of.
Chris, just before we move on to the next section, there's been a lot of talk about long COVID recently, but do you think there's going to be a bit of an issue of kind of long lockdown insofar as not only it just dragging much further than we might like, but also there's already been some indications from Chris Whitty that he might prefer some restrictions at the end of this year, suggestions about maybe this is the way that we deal with seasonal viruses or just future pandemics full stop. Is there an issue here with these tactics kind of being normalised in the near future? Or do you think that after having gone through this horrendous ordeal, no government's ever going to want to touch this again lightly?
Yeah, I just wish these people would wind their head in. I mean, they've got what they wanted. We're in lockdown again for probably quite a while. And they just keep giving you more and more downers. Now, there's a study, probably bloody Imperial again, I expect, usually is saying that rates were rising. I mean, rates obviously are not rising, have not been rising in January. They have definitely been falling. They came up with some Mickey Mouse graph, put a line through it in a way that I couldn't see how they could possibly put a line in that direction, and said, we think rates are rising. People need to do more to make sure the virus stops spreading. We have all this stuff from Sage say we can't open the pubs until summer. Just leave it out for a bit, for God's sake. You know what I mean? We're in lockdown in January. Give people a bit of hope rather than putting a dampener on things and saying this is like the new normal, because it feeds the conspiracy theorists. You've got conspiracy theorists saying lockdowns don't work, and then Imperial come out saying this lockdown isn't working. How is that helping anybody? You know, but and it's not true. So they need to shut up. You know, obviously, I think we said from day one on this podcast, one of the big dangers of this whole thing is it's going to give the natural authoritarianism of the public health lobby a huge shot in the arm, to excuse the pun. And they'll start thinking that they can do all sorts of things, and with good reason, because they've got away with more than they ever thought they could get away with. Doesn't mean I don't support this lockdown, by the way. I still do. But at some point, I will stop supporting it because it will have achieved its aims. Whereas Chris Whitty and Sage and Piers Morgan, all these people, will want to keep the lockdown until nobody at all ever dies from a respiratory disease. So that's the real battle to come. But for now, you know, these people should really just give it a break.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. While we're on the subject of the kind of megalomania of the public health lobby, I want to talk about sin taxes briefly, which is a kind of form of nanny state authoritarianism that seems almost quaint by kind of current comparisons, but nevertheless, very important. We've talked about it a lot on this podcast. Onward, the Right of Centre think tank had a report out recently suggesting that the government, as part of this levelling up agenda that they talk about so much, should look at things like sin taxes on alcohol and tobacco, because not only is it does sin taxes prove to be very regressive in practice, but also seems to be having a bit of an impact on geographical inequality, if you like, people in London paying less on these sin taxes in other parts of the country. So Chris, what was your reaction to this report? And do you think, given how much Boris Johnson in particular has been a bit of a convert to the nanny state, it seems, over the past year, do you think it's likely that the government will look at these kinds of things going forward?
I can't really see them cutting any taxes for the foreseeable future, can you? No, we've got national debt is 2.2 trillion, I think, now. Difficult to keep track of it. I really don't think they'll do it, partly because, as Nigel Lawson said way back in the 80s, in reference, I think, to tobacco duty, could have been fuel duty, could have easily been both, they're the only kind of taxes you can raise and people thank you for it. People, you get pat on the back. Not from everybody. Obviously, the little man doesn't get his say, but from various campaign groups and so on. So it's not going to happen. I'm glad Onward have raised it. It's an important one because they are so blatantly regressive. And also there's an interesting aspect with regards to Brexit, which is about the illicit trade. You know, it tends to just be people like me and people from industry who bring up the problems of, you know, you raise tax in one area and people will find a way to get it cheaper, which ultimately means the black market. But Australia and New Zealand are seeing this on an epic scale at the moment. In Australia, a pack of cigarettes costs about £18, and it's not a lot cheaper in New Zealand. And although these places are, you know, not obvious spots for kind of cross-border shopping or, you know, cross-border smuggling, particularly New Zealand, it's going on a big scale, and you're seeing enormous amounts of smuggling, massive busts in Australia. Just vast tobacco farms, you know, where they're illegally growing tobacco and then processing it. In New Zealand, where they haven't really got the climate for it, you just get loads of robberies of what they call dairies, which are basically corner shops over there, happening a lot because it's the most valuable thing in the shop now. You know, a pack of cigarettes is, you know, you get a whole load of them. You've really got thousands upon thousands of pounds. So there's a big problem with that. What's going to be the effect of Brexit on this? So we've got the trade deal, but we still haven't got the, and we never will have again, presumably, we haven't got the access to the common market in the sense that we can just go in and buy as much booze and cigarettes as we want to. So we can get 200 cigarettes now, and you can get them at proper duty-free prices. So it's peanuts, you know, 50p a pack, whatever it is. But you can only get 200. So unless you're a very frequent traveller on the Eurostar, then you're not going to keep yourself stocked up for very long. My boss, Mark Littlewood, is very upset about this. I think he only recently found out what's going on because he buys whole suitcases of cigarettes when he goes to Mallorca every year, and it lasts him until the next time he goes. But that option is no longer available to the British smoker. Tobacco duty is about the only source of government income that's actually gone up under lockdown because people are unable to go to Europe, basically. But what's going to be the long-term effect? Are more people going to quit because they can't get access to cheap cigarettes? Are they going to go on the black market? Or is there a third option? I mean, people do tend to sort of downtrade to cheaper cigarettes and then to rolling tobacco. But once you get to rolling tobacco, the only real place to go is the black market now. It used to be the EU, which you could do kind of legally. There was a lot of kind of grey market activity there, people bringing back cigarettes from their friends and stuff. But that's totally cut off now. And I suspect what we'll see, what is already a very big illicit market in Britain, becoming substantially bigger.
Tamandra, I know you looked into the subject of sin taxes before. I think that they seem to strike a lot of people as just common sense. But why do you think they're so problematic in the sense of either restrictions on people's liberties or just being regressive, as Chris was discussing?
Well, I think both. I mean, it's interesting. I've got a Radio 4 series on at the moment called Steel Manning, in which basically I pick my opinions and then I pick someone to argue against them really strongly so I can put them through their paces. And February the 10th is about sugar tax, in fact, but sin taxes. So that's what I'll be arguing about.
Who have you got on?
Camilla Cavendish.
Oh, yeah.
Who, of course, was involved in originally drawing up the original sugar tax when she was in Cameron's administration. And, yeah, this is my argument that it's twofold. Basically, first of all, that it's our business if we want to do unhealthy things. I think this is going to be a much harder argument to make in the future. I think up till now, there has always been an element of, well, it's not fair if you put a burden on the NHS with your unhealthy habits and you go, well, you know, you go around your bicycle. What you're saying, if you get knocked off, you shouldn't be allowed in hospital because you shouldn't have been riding a bicycle. You know, I think it's a very poor argument. But I think in the wake of COVID, it's going to be a much stronger argument because the idea that we should protect the NHS instead of the NHS looking after us has really got dug in. But the other thing is that it's very regressive because it's a tax on stuff that you buy instead of on your income. If you haven't got much income and you choose to spend it on a few small pleasures like cigarettes and sugar for your tea, I know they're not actually yet taxing sugar for your tea, but full sugar fizzy drinks, and then you get penalised more. Whereas if you spend most of your income on the upkeep of a yacht in the Pacific, which we now discover is in fact just a cover for a smuggling operation to New Zealand, then what you spend on booze and fags is small fry. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's very worrying. Although, as you say, politically it's very inviting because it's quite hard to stick your head out and say, I don't see why smokers should have to pay more for their pleasure than people who enjoy drinking oat milk. Like, you like oat milk, they like smoking. Who decided that one pleasure is a sin and one is a virtue just because you can point to the headline health impact of this one? I am definitely now going to save up, by the way, buy a yacht and smuggle tobacco. I'm really tickled by the idea that governments around the world are gradually legalizing cannabis and simultaneously clamping down on tobacco so people can openly grow and sell cannabis in various countries. And tobacco is secretly grown and smuggled. Who'd have thought, eh? Who'd have seen that coming?
Chris, on that point, you've talked a little bit about how politically it would be very difficult for them to roll this back. But do you think socially there's also going to be an element of, because we have been bombarded with that message, as Tamandra was saying, and wrote a very good article on this subject, protect the NHS. And this has always been part of the argument as to why people, to justify public health, really, was the fact that, you know, this is again putting too much burden on the health service, etc. Do you think there is going to be, I don't know, just even less appetite than there was before, potentially, for taking on some of these nanny state things because of the last 12 months we've been through?
I don't know. I think most people want to completely forget about this whole nightmare, really, and if anything, swing completely the other way. You know, it kind of like the roaring 20s after the First World War or whatever. Although, of course, they had prohibition in America after the First World War, so that doesn't really work. But it could go that way. I mean, the argument for kind of protecting the NHS going forward from things like flu is really very weak. I mean, the protect the NHS argument makes sense now, because if the virus was allowed to run riot, then you would genuinely have hundreds of thousands of people needing to be in hospital and we wouldn't be able to treat them. Whereas the flu, yeah, we have a winter crisis every year. Other countries don't have a winter crisis every year. Maybe there's something wrong with the NHS. Maybe we should expand capacity for the flu season. But we know, roughly speaking, how big the flu season is going to be. It varies, of course, year to year. But it's not a big shock when we have a winter flu season. Whereas this is a shock. We can't realistically expect to expand the NHS to the point where it can take every possible COVID patient if the entire country has COVID. But we can reasonably expect the NHS to do what every other health service does in Europe, which is to have the capacity to deal with normal winter flu.
And Tamandra, just before we leave, just on that point that Chris is really, hopefully end on a bit of an optimistic note, there's this kind of sense of, like, particularly because of lockdowns kind of bludgeoned people, made people quite scared about going outside, wary of being one another. Do you think there is just going to be such a sense of relief that people are going to rush back out into the pubs? Is this going to be a kind of a huge kind of level of excess, or is it going to be slightly more cautious and kind of blinking into the light when these restrictions are lifted?
I expect there'll be a split. I think there'll be people who are cautious and continue to be cautious for ages and are also more rattled about things like the flu that we took in our stride before. But I think a lot of people, certainly me included, will be out there making up for lost time, are really hoping for the roaring 20s. Somebody said yesterday, the fine for attending illegal house parties under lockdown is going up to 800 quid. And I quite spontaneously said, yeah, this goes on much longer. I will happily pay 800 quid to go to a party. That will seem like cheap at the price.
But then, well, the government's going to pay you 500 quid for getting COVID. So it's really only £300.
Well, is it,
and if you split it amongst all the people there.
I've already had COVID, so I'm not going to get it again. So, you know, I'm on a loser there. No, I think they will. I think the fact is, humans need each other and we need to have a good time and we need to feel our freedom. And people have been remarkably stoical over this. I think people have been too frightened, but people have also been very stoical and public spirited and gone, all right, well, I'm not worried for me, but I don't want other people to catch it. So I'm going to put up with often quite irrational limits on my freedom. And I think that once it's clear that you can actually do these things without putting either yourself or anybody else at significant risk, I really hope people are going to get out there and go, oh, human contact, having a good time, singing, dancing, skin-to-skin contact with people you've only just met. I mean, my God, I'm going to be shaking hands like there's no tomorrow.
And on that note, we'll end. But Tamandra, Chris, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated.